Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry, where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.
Providing insight and resources for your spiritual journey. Unity Online Radio.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions with Paul John Roach, minister of Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Discover the universal principles present in all the world's religions and take an incredible journey to new understanding. Now, here is your host, Paul John Roach.
So, hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from Unity Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Today, I welcome back to the show prolific author, internationally acclaimed theologian, prophet for our times, and champion of creation spirituality, Dr. Matthew Fox. Matthew Fox's latest book focuses on some aspects of the legacy of seminal theologian and author Thomas Merton, and it's entitled A Way to God, Thomas Merton's Creation Spirituality Journey. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Matthew Fox back to World Spirituality. We're glad you're with us.
Thank you, Paul. It's good to be back.
You know, as always, it's a joy to read your book. It's a passionate, well-researched, generous in its quotations and explorations, and as always, direct, and although erudite, speaks to the everyday person. So that's quite praise for the book, isn't it? But here comes the caveat, okay? Matthew, how would you respond to those who might say, yes, all those things are true, but I find more Dr. Fox in the book than Dr. Merton? You know, is Merton's work pushed into the framework of creation spirituality and its four paths? So how would you speak to that?
Is it a Procrustean bed? Well, first of all, as I the very title comes from a letter that Merton wrote me, and right. As I tell the story in the book, Merton was very influential in my journey and in my discovery of creation spirituality, because it was he who sent me to the Institut Catholique in Paris to get my doctorate in spirituality, and it was there that I met my mentor, Père Chenu, who named the creation spiritual journey tradition for me. And and then Merton died just a year after we had corresponded, and also he sent me a large package of his writings that had not yet been published and so forth. So we had a relationship going, and the very title of the book, A Way to God, is from his letter to me, where he said that it's really important that we be dealing with the mystical side of things and not just practical things. He says what people want of us, after all, is the way to God. So, what I'm trying to do is show that to understand Merton in all of his depth and breadth, and of course Merton wrote voluminously, he wrote books and died at 53 years of age, you need, it really helps to have a pattern and a way to understand the tradition that he discovered. And he discovered it really beginning in 1958, because he broke with his the dualistic, Augustinian, guilt-ridden tradition that he had taken on beginning in 1940 when he entered the monastery, Trappist Monastery. And he was ready for a change when he met Dr. Suzuki, the Japanese Zen Buddhist, teacher who brought Zen to North America, and it was Suzuki who urged him to read Meister Eckhart, who he said is the greatest mystic of the West. And so Merton shifted gears entirely beginning in 1958 when he started to read Meister Eckhart. And so that, too, is another link between Merton's work and mine, that both of us were profoundly affected by Meister Eckhart, the 14th century Dominican, who was condemned by the Pope a week after he died. In fact, Merton, the last days of his life, was writing in his notebook, "Eckhart is my lifeboat, Eckhart is my lifeboat." So I don't think I'm forcing anything here. What I'm doing is demonstrating that the four paths of Krishna Maitreya are profoundly experienced by Merton and beautifully addressed, because Merton was a real artist, an amazing writer and poet, and he could really say things that that hit the gut and the heart and not just swim around in the head. And so I think that a lot of the beauty and depth and breadth of Merton's work comes out thanks to the four paths of creation spirituality.
Well, and like I say, you do, you know, quote wonderfully his works and everything, and it fits the four paths very well. And obviously he had a keen understanding of each of those ways of approaching the divine, you know, and how to live the seamless life. And so it's kind of fascinating to see the correlations there. And thank you for letting me be the devil's advocate there on that one, because, you know, and I don't mean to insult you or anything, but, you know, I think there is, you know, you have your own legacy, don't you? In many ways, you know, you have that similarity too, both, you know, very seminal figures and prolific writers. So it's interesting to see the commonalities, but I think also some of the differences, and we can talk about that in a little bit. But I love the idea that these four ways to God embrace all aspects of our humanness, right? And you mentioned that it's not just about intellectualism; it's about how to live it. And I love the cover, which is sort of like an iconic cover of a piece of artwork of entitled Thomas of the Desert, and it's telling that he carries a hoe and also a pen, and he's standing in a circle, a sort of a Zen calligraphy circle there of wholeness, and his cassock is blowing in the wind here, and his arms are his sleeves are rolled up, so he's ready for work, and he has that look of focused direction in his eyes. So it's a wonderful image, I think, which to me sums up Thomas Merton. You know, such a well-rounded person. Why is it that some people, Matthew, you know, become like you say, an industry almost? You know, the Merton industry, they stand up head and shoulders above others. Is it because they are able to articulate perhaps the feeling of the age, or are they truly just exceptional?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's both. And of course, Merton became a real public figure when his first book came out, his autobiography, in 1948 after the war. And it's called Seven Story Mountain, and it sold millions of copies. And I think part of the appeal was that, of course, many men had come home from the war and had what today we have a name for, post-traumatic stress disorder. But I think they found his life of contemplation in the monastery, which he wrote about so eloquently, to be very appealing. And one thing that happened is that the monastery became swollen with new recruits, if you will, new novices, when his autobiography came out. So a part of then his appeal was the timing, I think, mm-hmm. that he was offering a contemplative invitation to living and even to vocation, which I think hit a lot of people after the war. People were, let's face it, pretty darn exhausted by all the pain, the suffering, and death, action that was demanded during the war. So I think that's part of it. But also, he just wrote very candidly and convincingly about the inner life. And it's hard to write about mysticism. As William James, psychologist, says, that ineffability is part of the sign of a mystical experience. And so it takes an artist. It takes artists to articulate what happens deep in the soul. And Merton had such an artistic gift. And by the way, you commented on the cover of the book that this painting was done by a Jewish fellow who admires Merton very much. And I think that's very interesting that the cover of the book is this monk, as you say, with eyes staring ahead and all. But the painting was done not by a Catholic or a Christian, but by a Jewish admirer of Merton. And Merton was such an ecumenical figure, you know. I mean, part of the unity philosophy is, of course, to look for what's common in all the world religions.
Right.
Well, Merton was way out front on Buddhism, for example. And in his last trip to Asia, he met the Dalai Lama, who was only 33 at the time. They really hit it off, so much so that they each canceled their appointments for the next day and spent two full days together. Thich Nhat Hanh was close to Thomas Merton. In fact, he nominated him for a Nobel Peace Prize. And, of course, Rabbi Zalman Schachner visited him several times in the monastery. And Rabbi Heschel and he had a very profound correspondence. And Heschel sent him his book on the prophets as soon as it came out in 1962 or 63. And Merton jumped at it, just loved it. So there was this ecumenical depth and spirit to Merton that really comes through. And I think even the painting that you commented on that's on the cover of the book is part of that story of how,
yes,
how appealing Merton is to people of many faiths and of no faith. He had correspondence going with Pasternak, with Henry Miller, with all kinds of poets in South America. With Joan Baez came and to his place, and they had a picnic out on the monastery grounds. He was just very open to truth and beauty wherever he found it.
And I think that's a hallmark of his life, that he was very teachable. You know, he was always learning and deepening, right? And that made him attractive, I think, to many people, because they were following along. They were seeing where his next development took place. And so it wasn't like he was talking down from, you know, a high eminence here. He was exploring the journey with
exactly.
others.
Exactly. He was curious right up to the end. And, you know, when Rachel Carson's book on Silent Spring came out, which is pretty much recognized as the first and iconic book on ecology, she was immediately fired by her science department, who called her an hysterical woman who was in love with bunnies and trees. But Merton jumped at the book and wrote her a 3-page letter praising her for it, saying that because of the book they were going to cease to use DDT on the monastery grounds, and going on about how the the bird population was definitely dwindling on the monastery farm, and her scientific investigation helped to explain why and so forth. So he was immediately into the ecological movement. And just a few years before he died, he started correspondence with Rosemary Ruther, who was only 29 years old, a feminist theologian, a Roman Catholic, and they had a correspondence that was very strong. She was not at all easy on him, but he took the criticisms, and they had a very live dialogue by letters over a 2-year period. So, like you just said, he was very teachable. He was eager to learn, and he was never content with just sitting on past laurels or past philosophies. He was very engaged in the current conversations of the day, including, of course, he was the first religious figure in America to come out against the Vietnam War, and this probably cost him his life.
Yeah, and you talk about you know, how he died in Thailand and Bangkok there when he was, like you mentioned, 53 years old, and some people think it was mysterious how somebody as pragmatic and grounded as he was would suffer that kind of electrocution in this. It wasn't like it was a rundown hotel, you know, somewhere in the heart of Bangkok. It was a retreat center, and you mentioned that you think it was an assassination, right?
I do, and he had just finished a talk entitled Karl Marx and Monasticism, which was not the most prudent topic to talk on in 1968 in Southeast Asia when the Vietnam War was raging at its height. And 3 hours later, he was dead. And so I've spoken now to 3 CIA agents who were in the area at the time, and I asked them, did you kill Merton? One said, I'll neither affirm it nor deny it. The second one said that he said we were wallowing in money and cash in the CIA at that time and that place, and there was absolutely no accountability whatsoever. So he said any single CIA agent who felt Merton was a threat to America could have had him done in with no questions asked. Then the third person I talked to last month after the book came out, and when I asked him, he said, yes, we killed him. And so I think it's very possible that he was murdered. He was getting his mail intercepted and his phone calls, just as was Dr. King the last couple of years of his life. He was very active insofar as he was coaching. He was a mentor to Phil Berrigan and Daniel Berrigan. Dan Berrigan just died a month ago, who were activist Catholic priests who went to jail a lot protesting in nonviolent ways the war. And so it was no secret that he was an outspoken critic of a lot of American goings on at the time, including the race issue. He supported King when it was dangerous to do so, and he supported Malcolm X as well. And he also wrote convincingly about Native American genocide in America. So he was not afraid at all to take up the critical issues. And he also was very critical about religion itself, what he says and about Catholicism at times and about Christianity, how often he says Christians are worshiping a Christ who is a wax idol and not the real thing. So his criticism is not restricted to the American government, but it covers his conscience and consciousness vis-a-vis all of his participation as a human being in social communities.
Right. Yeah, definitely a courageous man.
Yes.
And also had a premonition. You talk about this, you know, premonition of him dying young, right? They didn't think he's going to live too long, and even talked about electrocution, I think you mentioned.
Yes, in one of his poems, he actually talks about being charred and in Vietnam. Yeah, he had that premonition. I think it's one thing that may have driven him as much as he was driven to work so hard. It's not just the 60 books he wrote, but his correspondence. So when you realize, you know, there was no email. There wasn't even a computer. He was doing all this correspondence, pecking away on a typewriter. And it's just amazing how many letters he wrote in his lifetime. He was a very hard worker, and of course, in monastic tradition, you get up in the middle of the night a couple of times to pray and so forth, so he didn't get a whole lot of sleep.
Well, it seems like almost he was exhausted, you know, that he talks many times about wanting to have more solitude, right, and get away from it all, because he was inundated with admirers and priors and people who just wanted to some of his time, and I think it got old, didn't it, for him?
Well, that's right. Solitude is very precious to him, which is why he talked the abbot, although it took him 6 years to convince the abbot, to let him live in a hermitage on the monastic property, but away from the larger community. And he liked that very much, being out in the woods, and there was more quiet and solitude there. But also, and it was closer to nature, but he was dreaming about going to some other place when he came back from Asia, maybe the Redwood area of California, which he had visited, or maybe Alaska, or maybe New Mexico. Those were the 3 places he was looking at seriously, not to end his relationship with the monastery, but to have like a leave of absence or something where he could have more solitude and a simpler lifestyle. Because, as you say, even in his hermitage on the monastery grounds, he was still very well known. He tells one story that makes me laugh about he was returning to his hermitage one day, and there were three priests on his front porch waiting for him to come home, whom he had not invited and did not know. So he hid behind a tree until they went away. And for me, I understand that, being something of an introvert myself, you know, that you can only spend so many hours a day with other people, and you do need your solitude. And so that is a pretty telling story, I think, about how, as you say, fame is a double-edged sword, and he was suffering from it. And then you mentioned earlier, too, the whole industry around Merton. He himself complained that the monks were forcing him to write books all the time. They were making money. They were getting recruits because of his writing. And at times he felt he was being used, and that was while he was alive. I think after he died, the monastery kept coming out even more of his books and collection of his works. And so there's been this kind of Merton, I call it the Merton factory, that's it makes me a little cautious. So this is one reason why I've not really written about Merton that much before, although I do quote him certainly in my books. In fact, one of my books I dedicate to him and to Rabbi Heschel. But I kind of kept my distance. I knew I had my own calling and my own direction I had to go. But I've enjoyed very much doing this book because it's kind of been a full circle for me, because I read him when I was a teenager. I read his autobiography, and that inspired me. And then, of course, we had this correspondence in the 60s, and I owe him a lot. As I say, all the trouble I've gotten in, I owe to Thomas Merton.
Right. Folks, I'm with Matthew Fox. We're talking about his latest book on Thomas Merton. It's called A Way to God. It's yet another book in the wonderful oeuvre of Matthew Fox's life, and to add to the joy that we've experienced so many times. When we come back, I want to share a little bit of serendipity or serendipitous experience I had on page 177 of this book. So we'll talk about that when we come back after these messages from Unity. Join us then.
Unity Online Radio brings you inspiring programs on a variety of spiritual topics. Giving to the network is now easier than ever. Simply text Unity Radio to 72727 from your smartphone. You can make a one-time or recurring donation. Your gifts help us offer enriching spiritual programs that reach listeners around the world. Text Unity Radio to 72727. Thank you for your support.
Hello, listeners. Did you know we've gone mobile? That's right. Your favorite Unity online radio programs are available on your mobile device. Now you can take us with you wherever you go. Using apps from Live 365 or Stitcher, you can listen to Unity online radio live or on demand. To learn more, visit www.unity.fm and click on mobile listening.
World as it is. The world is full of voices, advertising, television, politics, colleagues, family, and friends. All are too happy to tell us how to live. In all of that noise, it's easy to miss the one voice that matters, your own soul. What would happen if you could hear that voice? Imagine the clarity, confidence, and courage that would be yours, and the life you could create. Join Janet Connor, best-selling author of Writing Down Your Soul, The Lotus and the Lily, and Your Soul Wants Five Things, as she and her guests explore how to hear the call of the soul and create the soul-directed life. Live Thursday at 1 p.m. Central, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Go inside to find my God.
You've been listening to World Spirituality with host Reverend Paul John Roach. To learn more about Reverend Paul John Roach, visit his website, pauljohnroach.com. Or if you have questions, email him at pauljohnroach@yahoo.com. We now return to World Spirituality.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm with Matthew Fox, and we're talking about his latest book, published by New World Library. It's available in all the usual outlets. It's called A Way to God, Thomas Merton's Creation Spirituality Journey. And I was halfway through the book, and the section was on original sin, original blessing. And of course, original blessing is one of my favorites of Matthew's books, because there's so many cool ideas there. It's a source book of many wonderful things, and I like it, especially the back where there's a list of famous theologians and mystics of the various ages, and Matthew gives them a star system of how close they are to creation spirituality, which is fun. And I noticed Jesus gets 5 stars. That's good. But there's also the comparison between full redemption theology and a more creative unity style theology, which is based on the positive rather than the original blessing rather than original sin. So I was reading like I say on page 177 about this and Merton's comments, and it seems that all so sad to me. It just hit me how very, very sad human beings are sometimes, that we need to beat ourselves over the head with this original sin concept, and how anxious we all are about that. And then I turned over the page, and the words sadness and anxiety were right there in the poem. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is serendipity. And I'm just thinking these thoughts, and there they are in a beautiful poem by Merton. So if you don't mind, I'll read this poem. It's called First Lesson About Man. Man begins in zoology. He is the saddest animal. He drives a big red car called anxiety. Whenever he goes to the phone to call joy, he gets the wrong number. Therefore, he likes weapons. He knows all guns by their right names. He drives a big black Cadillac called death. Now he's putting anxiety into space. He flies his worries all around Venus. But it does him no good. Man is the saddest animal. He begins in zoology and gets lost in his own bad news. I love that. It's kind of depressing.
Isn't that wonderful? I'm so glad you liked it, because I sure did. And it's fun to hear you read it. Usually I read it.
Well, thank you for letting me read it. This
you did a great job.
There's some lacunas in here. I presume that's not the full poem, right?
Yes, it's a bit longer.
Yeah, good stuff. I'll have to research and get the whole poem. But
oh, yeah.
We are filled with this anxiety, and it seems to be getting more and more prevalent. As we go into election season for our new president, etc., and all the constantly repeating atrocities that seem to be happening. The latest one, of course, is Orlando, and it seems like the American people, and maybe the people of the world, are a little on edge right now. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Absolutely. And of course, he says we go to the phone to call joy, don't get the wrong number. Therefore, we like weapons and know all guns by their right names. So the connection there between the absence of joy in the heart and the weapons. And of course, that's becoming a bigger issue. And then his point about we fly our worries all around Venus, but it does us no good. So Merton, living in the 60s, the big technological issue of his time was getting to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
But he actually criticized that effort. He said, even ants can fly, he said. the bigger journey, the most important journey, the harder journey, and the deepest discovery is to examine our own beings and find out what separates us from ourselves. This is a journey we're afraid to take. And he said, if we don't take this journey, then all of our trips into space, we're just going to be bringing our stuff into space. And that's exactly what he's talking about here, that we're going to fly our worries around Venus. So today, of course, the big technological news is not about getting to the moon. It's about iPhones and Silicon Valley and all these gadgets, which, by the way, everyone in ISIS has one. The killer in Orlando, in the middle of his killing, picks up his iPhone, etc., and even he's texting away in the middle of his killing. So clearly, redemption is not to be found in technology. I mean, we're just crazy if we think it is. The real issue is the human consciousness and the human psyche and the human soul. What's missing there? That's what we should be exploring. And I actually wrote an article the other day about Orlando, and I said, I think that Silicon Valley, which is so well represented in ISIS and in killers like Orlando, they should put a tax on themselves. And that money should go to exploring these questions that Merton is raising and that all the mystics are raising about who we are as a species and why we're so prone to evil and self-hatred and hatred of others. Let's put some money into that research, because all the spiritual groups that I know that are doing serious work on this, you know, they're all hungry for a little bit of financial support, and they're not getting it as is needed. And I think that, frankly, I think that Merton is telling us that this is the area that needs the real discovery work, and gee whiz, gadgets are not going to save the human race.
Right. And, you know, and I can subscribe to that, but I can also see that there's a danger of throwing the proverbial baby out with the bathwater, you know. And you mentioned that that Merton himself had some surgery at one point in his life and for pain in his back, and was grateful for the expertise of the doctors. And I look at iPhones and I think, my goodness, you know, it used to take me hours and hours to research something, you know, and make trips to libraries, etc., which was fun in itself. But now I can just turn on my iPhone and find out everything I need to know, you know, right there, right then, when I need it. And that, to me, is fascinating. You know, it's like I'm carrying this this huge British library or Library of Congress, you know, in my pocket. And so you know, yeah, there's the downside to it. We're stuck with our heads in these things all the time. But I think there's wonders. It's a double-edged sword, I guess, right?
Oh, absolutely, and of course it can improve things for a lot of people. And as you say, it's a great source of knowledge. But is it a source of wisdom? You know, how can we move from just knowledge and information to wisdom? And for that, I think we have to do more of the inner work that Merton's talking about, and that Merton himself practiced. You know, and not just Merton, but the whole monastic tradition, East and West, that took seriously the capacities of human consciousness to develop more deeply and to calm the reptilian brain. It's the reptilian brain needs calming and not feeding at this time in history.
Well, you know, it's interesting how, you know, we choose certain paths, don't we? Choose certain ways to do things. I was recently in Great Britain for a couple of weeks and spending time in mostly rural areas and enjoyed it thoroughly. It's so lush and green over there. Mm-hmm. And but there's no what I call junk strip. You know, there's no sprawl. You leave a little village and then you're immediately in the countryside. You know, whereas in Texas, and I think in many parts of the states, you know, each town or village is surrounded by endless sprawl of different things, fast food joints, you know, car dealerships, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought, how can these 66 million people, it's not like Britain is a small population, it's very densely populated, and yet they can thrive and enjoy life without endlessly despoiling their landscape. And of course, they don't have as big a landscape to despoil as we do in the States, but I thought if it's possible for them, it's possible for anyone. And so it's just a question of volition, right? That we don't have to do these things. It's a choice to look at, you know, nature, for instance, as a resource to be exploited rather than as a living thing. And you have some wonderful passages, by the way, in the book where Merton, you know, lifts up nature and views things around the Gethsemane, his monastery and other places. When he went to India, obviously he was finally attuned to the wonder and awe of the natural world, wasn't he?
Absolutely, the via positiva there, yes, the experience of the sacred in nature. He was thoroughly affected by that, and he also gives credit to his Celtic ancestors.
Yes.
Tradition, nature was always considered wild and sacred. And you say all it takes volition, but it takes volition and values, you see. And I think that what you talk about, the junk strip and all that, I think that's kind of the shadow side to consumerism and consumer capitalism, that we've turned over so much of our visible world to corporations to do with what they want. And that's what, you know, in the UK and in France too, and many other countries, you know, there's more awareness, as you say, about how precious nature is, and how small towns and community living and so forth are of value. And of course, when you do surveys in America too, you get really the same results. David Corton, the economist, has done a lot of surveys about what really are the values of most Americans. And both Republican and Democrat, they agree on the importance of nature and community and so forth. But the dominant powers that be, the decision makers, including much of the media and certainly Wall Street and others, they're busy, you know, doing a lot of raping of nature and even the visual by billboards and all the rest that really is making our sense of the sacred bleed because.
Yes. Absolutely. I don't think I saw one billboard in Britain until we got close to London. There were a few there, but it's just astonishing, you know, because you're so used to it on every highway here in where I live. And
exactly. Yeah, it doesn't have to be that way. Like you say, volition, choices, plus values. And
yes.
That's where we need a debate. A lively
I want to get
debate.
Back to something that I read in the book about Meister Eckhart, Thomas Merton said, you know, he loved, as you said, that Eckhart was a lifeboat for him. But he said, Eckhart may be limited, but I like him. And I thought, limited, I wonder what he meant by that. Because I don't, you know, that's one of the last things I would think of when I think of Eckhart, because he's one of my favorite mystics. I resonate very much with his way of putting things. Almost, you have some people who said, you know, that could be me saying those things. Do you think he's limited?
No, but I think what Merton was being kind of political there, because I went and to the Thomas Merton Center in Louisville, which is the city nearest Gethsemane Abbey, and Merton spent a lot of time there, and he left his papers there at Bellarmine College, which is where his center is located. And I looked up some old classes that Merton taught in the 50s on the history of spirituality. He taught to his monks. And in one of them, this would have been around 56, he actually, when he talked about Eckhart, all he talks about is how dangerous Eckhart is, and he's been called a heretic and all this. So there was this, there are two Mertons. One is the Merton 1940 to 1958, and he was being extremely cautious about Eckhart. He doesn't. It's only in 58, thanks to Suzuki, that he started really getting into Eckhart. And so I think that statement, now we could look up exactly when he wrote that statement that you're responding to. I suspect it was very early in his discovery of Eckhart. I think he was kind of covering his back.
Yeah.
Because of Eckhart's condemnation. So I don't think we should take it too too seriously or too
well. Easily. Again, it's testimony to his willingness to grow and unfold. That, you know, he had that sort of mistrust of Eckhart early on, but then in the end, you know, very much embraced his theology.
So Eckhart had everything to do with his conversion to ecumenism, to interfaith, to opening up to the East. You know, I wrote a book, was it a year or two ago, and I show how Eckhart is he's called a Hindu by Hindus, he's called a Buddhist by Buddhists, yeah. He's called a Sufi by Sufis. I don't think anyone in history has been more interfaith than Eckhart, not because he studied Hinduism or Buddhism, but because he went so deep into his own soul and his own experience as a Christian mystic that he found the same pool of wisdom in his own journey that other traditions are found in theirs. And so I think that's what makes Eckhart so amazing and special in our time.
Right. So at the end of his life, you know, Merton was very much doing discourses and writing books on Eastern philosophy, wasn't he? Zen and the Birds of Appetite was one of his last books, I think. And he wrote a book on Chuang Tzu, Introduction to Chuang Tzu's Thinking, that I like very much. Obviously, as you say, was influenced by the great Buddhist intellectual, you know, D.T. Suzuki. So you think he was shifting, if he'd lived, do you think he would have shifted into a whole different direction there?
Well, also, you know, on his last journey, just a few weeks before he died, he had a profound mystical experience in Sri Lanka at a very famous Buddhist shrine.
Oh, yeah, the Polar
River. It's really kind of amusing about he was journeying with an abbot, you know, a Christian abbot, and the abbot didn't want to go near the shrine. He sat under a tree and read a book while Merton went, took his shoes off, and went to the shrine and had this profound mystical experience. And the abbot said something about, you know, I don't want to mix with pagans and so forth.
Yeah.
It just shows the two faces of the Catholic Church at that time, that one monk took off his shoes and went and had a profound mystical experience with the Buddha shrine, and the other one wouldn't even go near. He kept his shoes on and wouldn't even go near. So anyway, your question was about, was he headed a different direction? No, I think he was just headed in a deeper direction of that he was already on, that path of trying to find truth in all world religions, and including his own, and to demand more of himself and of others in terms of living out the truths that one discovers. And so his willingness to take on the cultural powers, whether it's technology, whether it's war, whether it's the media, he was very critical of the media. He has one amazing phrase where he talks about the Niagara of trivia that the media pours on us, you know, on a daily basis. Well, if he thinks it was bad in 1967, he should be around it. So, you know, he's so good at nailing and naming, you know, because he is a poet, the forces that we're up against, both psychological and social. And I think, I just think his journey would have continued. I think it's very likely that he would have gone away for a while into a more strict hermitage existence. I think he was definitely ready for more solitude at that time. But unfortunately, that didn't happen.
Yeah, but we have to affirm that everything's in divine order, right? That he had his 53 years. I think
that's right.
The same about Shakespeare sometimes. You know, Shakespeare died at 52 and yet managed to produce, 36 or so plays, you know, in that period of time. Very short life, but obviously.
And Dr. King died at 39. Good
there
heaven.
We go. You know, Dylan Thomas,
39
also. Yeah.
Yeah. So it is amazing, right? His work was finished, even though we didn't want it to be.
Yeah. So he was an interesting man in terms of eclectic in terms of sense of place, right? Because he grew up in the south of France, was born there at least, and his one parent was from New Zealand, the other was American, right?
And
he had antecedents in Wales as well.
Right. And his parents are both artists. They met at the Art Institute in Paris and fell in love. And then they got married, and he was born in Prades, a small town in southern France. So, he had kind of these a definite cross-cultural sensitivity. He knew French very well, for example, because he grew up in France. But his parents both died when he was a boy, which was quite a shock, obviously. And he was raised sort of by an uncle in England. And he had a very bawdy young manhood. He fathered an illegitimate child in England. And then he ended up at Columbia in New York. He did his master's degree there. And then he had his religion, and he was partying very much there too. In fact, I met a woman who dated Merton in New York, and I asked her what was that like, and she said he was very bright, and he was a lot of fun. He loved to dance, and he sure liked to party. But he had a conversion experience in Cuba at the Black Shrine, the Shrine of the Black Madonna there, when he was 26 years old, and it really changed him, of course. And within the year, he joined the Trappist monastery, a very strict order. And so, I think that a lot of the guilt and dualism that's present in his autobiography is his dealing with his bodiness and licentiousness as a young man. But one thing I appreciate about him is that he did not stick with that. A dualistic theology like St. Augustine did, who had a parallel experience as a young man. Augustine never got over it, and Augustine lived to be 76, but he never grew out of that issue of guilt and dualism and of anti-sexuality, whereas Merton did pull out of it, and that's what his conversion to Christian spirituality and Meisterhart was all about, really, and leaving that behind. And I praise him for that. And even though he lived 23 years younger, died 23 years younger than Augustine, I think he was a far greater soul because he grew. And I don't think Augustine grew that much. I think Augustine remained stuck in his guilt and has kind of dumped it on the Christian church for 1,600 years since, whereas Merton got through it all became a much more whole person before he died.
I think he was a romantic, wasn't he, is what I get from it. You know, he had a romantic view of nature and God and his role on this planet. And I mean that in the largest sense of the word romantic, you know, that he was in love with it in a way. Commitment and warmth in his writings.
Absolutely, a commitment of warmth. And there's a beautiful passage in the Via Positiva there, if I can find it, where he talks about the forest is his bride. Oh, yeah. I live in the woods out of necessity. I get out of bed in the middle of the night because it is imperative that I hear the silence of the night alone with my face on the floor. Say psalms alone in the silence of the night. The silence of the forest is my bride, and the sweet dark warmth of the whole world is my love. And out of the heart of that dark warmth comes a secret that is heard only in silence. But it is the root of all the secrets that are whispered by all the lovers in their beds all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a beautiful passage about connecting human love to the darkness of the night and to nature, to the forest. And he's so non-anthropocentric, really. He can really connect our deepest human passions with the passions of the earth itself. And, you know, I think he really has a profound ecological spirituality, therefore, in a profound via positiva.
Yeah, and reminds me actually of R.S. Thomas, a Welsh poet who was also a minister and wrote beautiful poems about God and nature, but a little more dark, I think. I think that there's a joy in Merton that you don't find in R.S. Thomas, but
that's
equally
a good point. That might be the French side to him, you know.
I'm Welsh myself, so I resonate with that idea that it's in your DNA. You know, that is that sort of mystical connection to a sense of place and to nature itself and to the liminal times of the day, you know, the dawn and the dusk and the nighttime and the whole thing, I think, is very interesting, you know, how that would come through in a conscious way for Merton. So that's fascinating for me.
That is interesting. I didn't know that you had Welsh blood, but yeah, it's
I grew up in Wales. Yeah, spent first 20 years of my life in Wales. Yeah.
Oh, okay. But so that brings it back. But again, I'm sure you caught the passage where he praises his Welsh ancestors.
Definitely caught that.
For that
of course,
Celtic
folks, I got to say when the show goes out live, Wales have just beaten Russia 3-0 in the European Championships, and so we're through to the knockout round, and this is the first time we've even got this far since 1958, since I was a little boy. And so it's a great, and it was the most magnificent performance I think that the Welsh team have ever done. So it's a very proud moment to be Welsh right now. So there you go. All right. As we draw this show to a conclusion, you know, what would you like to say? Well, I got two questions. Number one, what is the relevance, do you think, of Merton and his legacy for us today? What have we still got to learn from his writings?
Well, I think it's that marriage of deep contemplation and mysticism with action, social action, contemplation and action. And he did both, even though he was in a monastery where action that you wouldn't think would be front and center, but he managed to bring both into the picture. And I think this is very important for people today, especially young people who are feeling called to do something about the ecological crisis and about the wars between religions and ideologies and so forth. So I think Merton is a real champion about both the inner and the outer work that we have to do. So I think that's one of his great contributions, and his ability to be critical of culture at the same time, of course, that he honors the work of creativity that our species is so capable of. He was such a lover of art and music and the intellectual life and ideas, and he was such an artist himself in so many ways, including the art of friendship was important to him.
Hmm.
So I think he has so much to say today, and especially to the younger generation. And he says it so beautifully. He says it with passion and images. Well, it's that Welsh sense of the poetic tongue that comes through in his writing.
And so when you look at yourself, Matthew, and your legacy and all you've done, and hopefully for many more years to come. We're not going to put a line on that yet. But do you see, you know, you obviously see commonalities, don't you, with Merton? But how do you see yourself as somewhat different? What's your unique flavor that you've brought to us, you hope?
Well, of course, I got booted by the Pope. I think he would have been booted too, frankly, if he'd lived longer. And
right.
That part of the book too, where I take him through the so-called heresies that I was accused of, and show that Merton was on my side in each one of those charges. But I've had to be an administrator. Being a monk, you know, you don't have to worry so much about administration and raising money and all those things.
Right.
So I've paid my dues there, you know, and starting a university and so forth, and try to create a pedagogy by which people can be educated in their own spirituality. I was struck the Dalai Lama just spoke here in Sacramento, California, yesterday. One of the points it made was this, that as people are leaving organized religion, education becomes the most important place for teaching values, and we were talking about values earlier, you and I. And so, and this helped to ring a bell for me, because my life has been, my work has been a lot about trying to recover a working spiritual tradition, but also about how to implement it in pedagogy. And I've worked with inner city teenagers, and I've worked with a lot of adults, and I have a pedagogy that is proven. It really works. But I would love to see this spread more in other areas of education for the very reason the Dalai Lama said, because this is where values are either born or not born. And we have to start, I think, raising the value question more and more in our places of education as well as religion.
Yeah, it's very good. Yeah. Folks, let me tell you about next week's show, and then we'll say goodbye to Matthew. Next week, I'm going to explore a book that has been very seminal in my own spiritual unfoldment. It's called Mysticism, a Study and an Anthology by the great F.C. Happold. Wonderful book. Even though it's ancient now, it's got many gems in it. So I'm going to talk about F.C. Happold's book on mysticism. So join me next week for that. But right now, I want to really thank Matthew Fox for a wonderful hour. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I appreciate your all the work you've done over the years and all the wonderful books that have inspired so many. So thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for having a program like this where we can talk in depth about things that matter.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks. And thanks for listening, folks. Join me next week on that show about mysticism. All right. Take care now.
Thank you for tuning in to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach. Join us every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Central to further examine the spiritual teachings and religious traditions of our world and to discover the universal truth principles present in all. World Spirituality, only on UnityOnlineRadio.org, the voice of an awakening world. This program is brought to you in part by Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas, celebrating the Christ Spirit in all people. Online at www.unityfortworth.org.
Truly understand the laws of the universe and live a life based on these profound and unwavering truths, then your dream life starts today. No more waiting, no more wandering. If you're ready to let go of the striving and move into the allowing, you're ready for everyday attraction on Unity Online Radio. We study the teaching of Abraham given to us by beautiful Esther Hicks, so we can release confusion for clarity, exchange struggle for serenity, and have the time of our lives today. Join host Ray Zander every Friday at noon Central Time, 10 a.m. Pacific, on Unity Online Radio for Everyday Attraction, where the law of attraction gets real.
Ever said to yourself, I'm living a life I never intended to create? What life did you intend to create? Did you set goals? Did you work toward reaching those goals? If we don't have a specific goal in mind, or we don't know where we want to go, we may be likely to end up in places not of our choosing. Establishing goals along with guidelines on how to achieve them helps to keep us focused and energized, and often makes our lives more interesting, useful, and successful. It's never too late to take control of your life. Once you have your purpose clearly in mind, explore the various ways you can make it happen and visualize the process you believe can work best. Set goals, do what it takes to accomplish them, and enjoy your process.
This message has been brought to you by the Association of Unity Churches International. To find a Unity Church near you, visit www.unity.org.
Blissful stillness, come to me. Blissful stillness, come.
Tens of thousands of listeners, like you, have been transformed through the ministry of Paulette Pipe and her program, Touching the Stillness, one of the longest-running programs on Unity Online Radio. Paulette's latest album of guided meditations, Blissful Stillness, is a new and different experience. The mystical quality of her beautiful voice will reverberate through a Zen-style meditation, a mudra meditation, which are yoga hand positions to deepen your practice, and guided meditations, which we know and love. It features a new instrumental sound by Kelly Hunt with a bonus track by Kathy Zavada. Experience a blissful immersion into quiet and stillness by purchasing your own copy at shop.unityonline.org.
Blissful stillness.
Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry, where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.